From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Orange alert, yellow alert, orange alert. The nation's terror alert bounces up and down. And the reason? Chatter. Electronic intercepts that hint, maybe, vaguely, possibly, at another terror attack. All around you and around the world, Big Brother is listening hard, sucking up and processing mountains of words and data every minute, every hour. Maybe it works, maybe it doesn't, but it never stops. Tonight on Point, we go inside the secret world of global eavesdropping to explore the sources and surveillance of chatter. But first, we begin tonight with a document from the Department of Homeland Security that outlines scenarios for the most devastating potential terrorist attacks. The top 12 include the urban detonation of a nuclear bomb, a truck bomb explosion at a packed sports stadium, and the spread of the plague through public restrooms at airports. Eric Lipton covers Homeland Security for the New York Times and joins me now from Washington with the details. Eric, thanks for being with us tonight.
Sure. Good evening.
This was not a document intended for public consumption.
That's correct.
What was it? What are you reporting on here?
The Department of Homeland Security, under the instructions of the president, has been preparing national planning scenarios, which is a sort of an effort to try to sort of contemplate what are some of the worst things that could happen in terms of terror strikes against the United States, so that states and local governments can better prepare to perhaps ever have to deal with them.
You say it reads more like a doomsday plan. It was inadvertently posted on a Hawaii state government website, so now it's not just state and local government officials who know about it, it's everybody.
Right. The document actually, it looks like it was taken down last night before the story ran, so it hasn't been widely distributed still. I do have a copy of it. I downloaded it before they did take it off of the website. But it was intended to be shared with sort of emergency preparedness officials so that they could make comments back to the federal government before it became the official policy.
We'll look at how it might be used in preparing for a potential terrorist attack, but walk us through some of these scenarios in brief, if you would, Eric.
Sure. Well, I mean, they really are. It's quite a terrifying document to read. I mean, for example, there's one where the tanker trucks would be filled with anthrax, and terrorists would drive through three cities, just essentially spraying it out of the trucks in a way that no one would really be able to detect until the 24 hours or maybe even the 2 days later when people started to fall ill from anthrax.
And the impact of an attack like that?
Estimated 13,000 people would be dead.
They also talk about the explosion of a liquid chlorine tank. I'm not sure everyone, maybe I don't even understand exactly what the danger is there.
Sure. Liquid chlorine is used at sewage treatment plants in a lot of cities in the United States. It's mixed in with other materials to try to, you know, to clean what you flush. And it is extremely toxic. And the problem is that when liquid chlorine is heavier than air, so it floats along the ground, and it would create a cloud moving along, depending on the direction of the wind, that would potentially kill, they estimate,
this is a kind of toxic blanket.
Yeah, more than 10,000 people is the estimate in that one that because once the tank is exploded, it's impossible to contain.
Then they wrote about the potential spread of plague by somehow infecting bathrooms at airports, sports arenas, train stations, places where people would come and then disperse widely.
Right. Again, I mean, another really sort of scary scenario, although fewer dead than by anthrax or by a chlorine tank explosion. But in this case, a plague would be placed in the bathrooms. They speculate, perhaps, of, you know, an airport, a sports arena, and a train station. And the problem with this is that it would spread from person to person. While anthrax isn't contagious, the plague is. And so it would spread not only in the United States, but in several other countries, is what they anticipate.
All these are hypothetical. They've also got foot-and-mouth disease infecting American cattle with foot-and-mouth disease, costing hundreds of millions of dollars in losses there. And, of course, the big one, a nuclear attack of some kind. What's contemplated here?
Well, again, I mean, the thing about all of these is they're all hypotheticals. And, I mean, just to sort of interrupt with just this word of caution, and they do explicitly state that in none of these cases do they have any evidence that any of these plots are actively underway. And this is really, it's done not to create really a scary document, but to to so that the local and state governments can contemplate what would we need to be able to do in order to respond to one or perhaps more than one of these.
And as you've followed up on this today, do officials say that they're in position to effectively respond to one, two, three, any of this dozen terrible scenarios?
I think that in most cases, a few governments are prepared to respond to even a single one of these. But the thing that this provides is a, for the first time, once you have these scenarios developed and the population estimates of how many people would be injured, killed, and how big of an area would be affected, you can then sort of start to defend against. You can start to plan. You can start to see, you know, what kind of capacity would we need, surge capacity at our hospitals.
So to defend against, but also respond if it should happen, and
therefore, right.
And thereby lay out priorities for where money should be spent, where resources should be assembled.
Right. I mean, sort of, you know, what does prepared mean? You know, until you sort of define what your outer, you know, need might be, you can't really define preparedness. And I think that's what they're trying to do here is to set sort of an extreme, but a standard which they can then measure against and define what do we need to do to reach the point at which we can call ourselves prepared. That's what they're doing here.
A scary list. We saw it. Now it's gone again. But the idea is that there is preparation going on behind the scenes, or at least planning. Eric Lipton, thanks very much for catching it and reporting it.
Sure. Thank you.
Eric Lipton covers Homeland Security for the New York Times. He spoke with me from Washington. Intelligence agents depend on electronic chatter for clues, tips, hints about possible global threats. But who's listening in? How do they do it? And does it really work? Patrick Radden Keefe was a young American graduate student in England when he first heard tell of a mighty globe-circling surveillance network called Echelon. His ears perked up, way up, and so began his journey into the vast and shrouded world of global eavesdropping. What he found is making a lot of ears perk up. He learned that the United States has fewer than 5,000 spies operating around the world, but has 30,000 eavesdroppers, that the National Security Agency collects enough data on its spy satellites to fill the Library of Congress every 3 hours, that America's nearly invisible top surveillance agency has 3 times as many employees as the CIA. And he found that the government doesn't really want to talk about any of this. This hour on Point, chatter and the worldwide network of electronic surveillance that tracks everything from the whisper of terror threats to maybe you. You can join the conversation tonight when the government says they've picked up disturbing chatter that hints at a potential terror threat. Do you have any idea what they're really talking about? Do you trust the warnings pulled from chatter, from orange alerts to spooky rumors of looming threats? Do you know what is and isn't private today? Join us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me now from New York is Patrick Radden Keefe, a self-described average, curious citizen. He's a third-year law student at Yale and has written for the New York Review and of Books and Slate. His new book is Chatter, Dispatches from the Secret World of Global Eavesdropping. Patrick Radden Keefe, thanks for being with us tonight.
Thanks for having me.
So here you've marched out and written a whole book about something that's so elusive, and you did it as a young guy. You're getting a lot of kudos here. Seymour Hersh and other investigators are saying, bravo, we've got a new investigator on the scene. But you've done it in your own style. It's a kind of a picaresque tour of the planet looking for these outposts. What originally turned your head, Patrick?
Well, it was reading these stories. It was in 1999. I was reading stories while I was living in England about this thing called Echelon, and actually noticing that there was very little to no coverage in the American press of this kind of global eavesdropping. That sort of it struck me as a little strange that this was a big story in Europe, but the American press almost has an allergy to writing about this sort of thing. So it's funny, my book is primarily about the National Security Agency, which is the biggest, though most Americans haven't heard of it, is the biggest spy agency in the U.S. and indeed the world. And it's actually only the third book ever written about the agency in the U.S., and the first two were written by the same guy.
So secretly that some people have called the NSA no such agency, you remind us of Joseph Conrad's formulation of a blank space on the map being what he was drawn to, or his character was drawn to, in that case, this kind of edges of the world. But this is woven right through the world. It's all around us, as you describe it.
It is. I mean, it's interesting. We... we actually have bases, hundreds of bases all over the planet that were established at different periods of time, dating right back to the Second World War. And with our close Anglophone allies, the UK, Canada, Australia, and New Zealand, we've developed this network to, at least the intention, the aim is really to hear everything all the time.
You're a little bit coy about this. You describe this network, Echelon, as a conspiracy theory, but you present it as though it's a fairly concrete reality. So which is it?
It is a concrete reality. I mean, initially in the book, I have to pose it as a conspiracy theory because there's such a shortage of hard information in this area that if you put yourself in my shoes, reading stories about this planet-spanning network that my government supposedly ran while living in England, there were very few places that I could go to get concrete information. You know, if you went to Google and entered Echelon, you'd come up with thousands and thousands of hits. But those ran the gamut from the ACLU and various legitimate news and activist websites to conspiracy theorist websites that also give a great deal of time to everything from space invaders to Area 51 to various dodgy efforts to knock off JFK.
Lots of snapshots and insights into a world that we very rarely hear about tonight, though it hears about us a lot. We're going to be looking at all of that with Patrick Radden Keefe. His new book is Chatter, Dispatches from the Secret World of Global Eavesdropping. Listeners, you can join us tonight. When the government says it has picked up chatter suggesting a terror threat, do you have any idea what it's talking about who's listening and how and where and whom they're listening to? Do you know how deeply government surveillance can dip into all electronic communication? We're at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about the worldwide network of electronic surveillance that tracks everything from the shadow of terror threats to maybe you. My guest tonight is Patrick Radden Keefe. He's author of the new book, Chatter, Dispatches from the Secret World of Global Eavesdropping. You can join us tonight. Do you trust the warnings pulled from chatter, the orange alerts and spooky rumors of threat? Does the government trust chatter too much? And when Patrick Radden Keefe describes the epic scale of the surveillance apparatus globally today, do you feel threatened or more secure? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Patrick, you went out and saw a lot of fascinating edges of this world tonight, harder to get deeper than the edges sometimes. But we want to hear about those, but I wish you'd just take us first from where most Americans may have encountered chatter, and that is a warning comes out, or it's reported in the newspaper. Not long ago, we heard that Osama bin Laden has directed his Iraqi counterpart, al-Zarqawi, to go after the U.S., and it was chalked up to interception, or maybe there's an orange alert. When we hear that some new threat is being ascribed to chatter or the intelligence about it, what does that mean? Paint a picture of what's behind that little word.
Well, basically, we have this infrastructure for taking in communications all over the planet, and we do. We intercept billions and billions every day. What happens then is that the computers and the analysts at the agency try to sort as quickly as possible through this tremendous yield and isolate the messages that are going to be of some significance. A lot of the time, this happens too late. I mean, it's interesting. We will hear the chatter indicates that there's going to be attack. Sometimes after something has happened, we will hear that there was chatter in advance. So, for instance, on September 10th, 2001, we intercepted two messages between Saudi Arabia and Afghanistan saying, tomorrow is the zero hour and the match begins tomorrow. But nobody translated them until September 12th. So it's a real sort of paradox, this difficulty of you can collect a great deal, but then how quickly can you sort through it?
The scale of that boggles the mind right away. What exactly is it collected? Is it every telephone conversation, or just is it only things that are transmitted, you know, through the air so they can be snapped up like cell phone conversations? Is it our conversation right now? What's collected, first of all?
It depends on the medium. I mean, with something like satellite interception, it is a sort of a broadband approach. They'll just take in everything that goes over a particular commercial communication satellite. One of the things I had fun with in researching the book was that if you are trying to find the locations of various spy bases around the planet, one good way to do it is to find the locations of legitimate satellite ground stations that would be run by AT&T or something like that. And generally, within 40 or 50 miles, you'll notice there's also a U.S. Military or intelligence installation. So I went to a few of these.
Yeah.
And really, it's like putting a cup out in the rain. I mean, if the satellite signals are coming down to the legitimate base, you can also set up a spy base that will pick those up as well.
You say the air around us and the sky above us are a riot of signals. To intercept those signals is as easy as putting a cup out in the rain. But still, I'm left wondering. I mean, in the course of this hour, with a conversation, I'm sure we'll say terror and attack and bomb, and with this opening interview with the New York Times, you know, plague and nuclear and anthrax. How does the intelligence apparatus strain out what's just conversation about terror from what might be a terror threat?
Well, one key point to make right away is that you have to differentiate between text and conversation, spoken conversation like we're having now. So on the level of text, it's actually very easy to look for keywords. You do it every day when you go to an internet search engine. You enter a few words, and the search engine will automatically kick up the millions of websites that use those words.
But many of those websites could be the New York Times website or the Washington Post or...
Exactly. And that's a problem. And then even above and beyond that is the fact that I think this is the deeper problem. The terrorists know we're listening. So often, for instance, with this recent communication between bin Laden and Zarqawi, my hunch is that we hear what they want us to hear.
Mm-hmm.
There's a dramatic sort of cautionary tale for people who write about this area. And I actually think this is a clue to why there isn't more writing about this in the American press. But in 1998, the Washington Times revealed that we could listen into bin Laden. And the day that the story came out, he stopped using the phone. And hasn't since. I mean, this is the first story we've heard, this recent one about Zarqawi, that would indicate that he's doing anything other than using couriers.
Mm. So if text is difficult enough, when we go to spoken words that are maybe in a cell phone conversation, how are these collected? If every cell phone conversation is collected, how do they possibly, you know, zero in on what might be a threat?
Well, they have to be more discriminating with cell phone conversations. But, I mean, you have to remember, particularly with cell phones, because they use microwave towers, it's really the easiest of all of these various things to pick up. I actually went early on in my research. I went and visited a man who had done surveillance for MI5, the domestic British intelligence agency. Mm. And he told me he wanted to just sort of show me how transparent our communications are. And he told me he was going to take me around in his car. And he referred to his car as the Porcupine, which seemed a little strange.
Okay.
And then we got out to the parking lot, and there was his car, and it was a sort of inconspicuous-looking little sedan, except for the fact that it had 24 antenna all over it, sticking out spiky like a porcupine. And we got into his car, and he had all these receivers on the dash, and we drove around. This is in East Anglia in England, in real countryside, not a person in sight, but we drove around on these empty roads, and the inside of his car sounded like a cocktail party. We were intercepting cell phone conversations, walkie-talkie conversations, CB radio conversations. And this was just his way of illustrating for me that we don't really think about it when we use our cell phones, but the air around us is really thick with these signals.
How does a threatening conversation get pulled out of that babble?
Well, this is the thing. Because you can't isolate keywords, there is a sort of myth that it was one of the things I had to clear up in this project. There's a myth that if you say something on the line, the intelligence agencies will hone in on it. But there really isn't. That technology is not there yet.
So they have to be targeting you.
Yes, exactly. You have to target particular numbers and particular identities. Again, this is a challenge which a lot of our adversaries have been able to get around by using numerous cell phones. There was a strike in Yemen a few years ago of an al-Qaeda figure, and when they found him, he had half a dozen cell phones on him, and he would use each one just once and then discard it.
All of this coming under the category of signals intelligence, or SIGINT, to use the shorthand there. And to get back to your echelon construction, you describe this as being a kind of a cooperative exercise with the United States, Canada, the UK, Australia, New Zealand. A point that I hadn't thought of before. You say that each of these countries has laws that prohibit surveillance on its own citizens, but other countries are not permitted or are not forbidden from doing that. So that I guess what you're suggesting is hypothetically, the UK could surveil all of the United States on behalf of the U.S. government and then share whatever it found that looked incriminating or threatening.
Well, there have been reports of this kind of thing, and there have been some former spies, in particular a Canadian spy who worked at the Canadian Signals Organization, who said that on behalf of the British government, he had done eavesdropping on British civilians. There's also a bigger story from just a few years ago. In the run-up to the war in Iraq, when the UN Security Council was going to vote on whether or not to authorize an invasion, it was disclosed that the NSA had asked its counterpart in England, mm-hmm. GCHQ is the name of the organization, to do surveillance on UN delegates in New York City. Now, this was strange because, they are UN delegates and so not U.S. citizens, mm-hmm. and so wouldn't necessarily be protected by U.S. laws. But it was strange that the NSA wouldn't do it themselves. They actually sent this memo to the Brits saying, can you help us in this effort?
How do you interpret it, them asking the British to do it?
Well, I mean, one thing you realize is that the relationship, particularly between the NSA and GCHQ, its British counterpart, which really goes right back to just after the Second World War, is incredibly intimate. I mean, these two agencies are actually much closer than the NSA is, for instance, with the CIA or with the FBI. So intense and long-lasting has this cooperation between these different agencies been that there's actually better lines of communication between people working at the NSA and their British counterparts than there are with other people within the American intelligence community.
I was amazed by the scale of this surveillance operation. Lay out some of the numbers for us there about the size of the NSA relative to the CIA, the FBI, in terms of staff, in terms of resources.
Well, the NSA itself has some 60,000 employees, roughly 40,000 of whom go to work every day at Fort Meade in Maryland, which is their headquarters. But then there's another 20,000 who work at these bases all around the planet. So that's 20,000 people working just at American spy bases in other countries. The budget of the NSA is, of course, a very closely guarded secret, but is estimated now to be approaching $6 billion a year. And that's in conjunction with the National Reconnaissance Office, which is another very secret agency which builds the kinds of satellites that the NSA uses. And the NRO, the National Reconnaissance Office, itself has a budget of $7 billion a year.
And how do these staffing levels and budgets compare with better-known intelligence and law enforcement agencies, CIA, FBI?
Well, the NSA is bigger than the CIA and the FBI combined, just dramatically bigger. And that's just in terms of staff numbers. The budget numbers are even more interesting because this kind of electronic surveillance, and my argument is actually that this surveillance does not yield as much good intelligence as we'd like, it's very, very expensive. So, for instance, the single largest item in this year's intelligence budget is a photo reconnaissance satellite, so a very high-tech satellite that will take photos from space, but only during the day and only when there's clear skies. And this item cost $9.5 billion.
And this is the one that's going to be able to, zoom in on someone's pinky finger to read a tattoo?
That's the hope. That's the hope. I mean, there seems to be evidence to suggest that it won't do us much good because certainly our adversaries from Al-Qaeda to North Korean and Iranian weapons programs and what have you, they know that we have 100 defense and intelligence satellites in space. Anything they do above ground that could be photographed, we're seeing because they want us to.
I want to look at the
effect. But it's interesting.
Yes, please.
It's interesting to note that this $9.5 billion, there was actually somebody in the Department of Defense said when this number came out that for that kind of money, you could build a whole new CIA.
Raising the issue, which you do in the book, of whether or not intelligence reform efforts have been properly focused since 9/11. You traced this as best you could to some pretty far-flung corners of the planet. Like, we should give us a sense of this sprawling apparatus and how it shows up, how it shows up in the moors of England, how it shows up in Africa. Where did you find it? What did you see?
Well, the first place, and in some ways the most dramatic that I went, was the single biggest eavesdropping station on the planet, which is in England. It's in the Yorkshire Moors. And I just went to the base. I had heard about it, and I'd seen some pictures, and couldn't really believe that it was just there, sort of smack in the middle of the countryside. But I went, and it's amazing. The countryside itself is just there are cows and sort of crumbling stone walls and old farmhouses, and it really looks as though nothing has changed for 1,000 years. And then you come up over a hill, and you see this space base in the distance. There are 24 big white spheres, these things called radomes. They resemble massive golf balls.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, inside each one is a very powerful satellite dish. And the whole area, the base is 500 acres. It's surrounded by barbed wire, and there are armed men with machine guns who patrol the fence. And inside, 1,200 Americans live. And it's actually a town. I mean, they have their own restaurants and post office and what have you. And people live inside the base, inside the fence. And they come, and these are full-time eavesdroppers. That's what they do.
They listen, they analyze, and listen some more.
They do, yeah. They have code breakers and translators and analysts and various people who work in these massive underground basements sorting through this kind of basically churning, they would call it, all of this intelligence that comes in and trying to make sense of it.
Patrick, stand by. A lot of callers want to join us, and I want to begin to invite them in. David is calling from New York City. Hi, David. You're on the air.
Hi. Hi to both of you. I just wanted to congratulate you, Mr. Keith, on bringing this issue to the light. But actually, it should be relatively well known by now. I work for an advertising agency in New York, and one of our former clients is the American Civil Liberties Union.
Mm-hmm.
We did an ad that ran pretty extensively about 4 years ago in The New Yorker and the New York Times Magazine on Echelon. And we were briefed by the ACLU and wrote an ad that actually won some awards. But the fact of the matter is, I mean, among other things, the ACLU told us that the European Union had held hearings about Echelon back in the mid-90s, I think in 1996 or something like that. So it definitely exists. I mean, you definitely have hit all the things. I mean, I'm just nodding along to all the things you're saying, because in the briefings that, you know, in the discussions we had with the people at the ACLU, you know, all those things you're talking about,
we're right there, a kind of great secret right in plain sight. David, thanks for calling. Patrick, how about that? It's not a secret, and yet it's nearly invisible.
Well, it's kind of an open secret. I mean, this is the funny thing. I can give you a few funny examples. One is that the agreement that actually binds these five nations was signed in 1948. It was called the UK-USA Agreement, and its existence has been acknowledged by numerous former people from the NSA and so forth, but no current government official will admit that this agreement exists. It's more than 50 years old now, of considerable interest to historians, and a complete open secret, but certainly when I approached the agencies, none of them would give me an inkling. And there were actually funny moments in my research as well, where you'd get a glimmer of something, and you'd chase it down, and then suddenly it would disappear. So I actually found there was a website of a company called iJet Travel, which is a sort of, it does intelligence for intelligence gathering for business executives who are going to travel.
Sounds innocuous, yep.
Foreign countries, yeah, exactly. And the profile of one of the executives at iJet Travel, his corporate profile said that he had done a lot of contract work for the NSA. And in his little corporate profile, it actually said that one of the things he had done is he'd been instrumental in working on something called Echelon 2. And it said Echelon 2 was one of the most successful and prolific intelligence gathering programs that the NSA had ever used. So I wrote to this guy and said, hi, you know, I was looking at your website and your corporate bio here, and I'd love to talk to you about Echelon 2. Why don't we, you know, could we chat? And he wrote back and said, I don't want to talk about that. It's not something I want to get into. And I went back to the website the next day, and he'd removed that line from the corporate biography. So it literally vanishes before your eyes.
Off it goes. You describe the whole agency as kind of receding from view as the CIA and FBI got a big kind of going over in the post 9/11 period.
Well, this is one of the things that's amazing is that we've had this period of intense scrutiny of the intelligence agencies. And the CIA and the FBI, rightly or wrongly, have taken a real beating in the press and from Congress, the 9/11 Commission. But the NSA, which I would argue has made not a few mistakes, even quite recently, has managed somehow to evade scrutiny. And this, I think, is the downside of all this secrecy. I mean, there are real persuasive reasons for operational secrecy. But I feel as though that legitimate rationale has kind of broken its borders, and now we have a kind of a culture of secrecy that ultimately will make us less safe.
We're going to come back and look at that with Patrick Radden-Keefe. His new book is Chatter, Dispatches from the Secret World of Global Eavesdropping. Patrick, you quote John Updike here. Interestingly, you say, he says, from the dew of the few flakes that melt on our faces, we cannot reconstruct the snowstorm. I want to come back and talk about the effectiveness of this massive data-gathering apparatus around the world. Listeners, you can join us as well tonight. Do you trust the warnings pulled from Chatter? When the NSA has three times the staff of the CIA, are we relying too much on electronic surveillance? And is the all-seeing eye and ear a citizen's friend or potential worst enemy? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about the worldwide network of electronic surveillance that tracks everything from the shadow of terror threats to maybe you. My guest is Patrick Radden-Keefe, author of the new book, Chatter, Dispatches from the Secret World of Global Eavesdropping. You can join us tonight. Where would you draw the line between eavesdropping and privacy? Do you feel safer knowing that Echelon is out there working tonight? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Emma is calling from Worcester, Massachusetts. Hi, Emma. You're on the air.
Hi. Thank you. First, I want to say this is wonderful that we're having this discussion, and I'm really happy to learn about this. I'm not quite sure what I think about whether I feel more at ease or less at ease with Echelon out there, but within the last year, I remember seeing a sticker or some piece of the paper kind of informing citizens that if you use certain words in your emails, that they will be automatically sent to the government. And I was wondering if that's true, and if so, what words?
Emma, we've got it. Patrick?
It's a good question. I mean, we can only guess at the words. It's most certainly true that if you, particularly with email, because it is easy to sort through for keywords, that if you were to put together something that really looks suspicious, you'd get picked up. I mean, the great sort of funny example of this is that actually back in the 90s, so quite a while ago, there were a couple of kids of high school kids, somewhere in New England, and they went to the website during computer class of the White House and sent a little email to it saying, "Kill Bill." This is during the Clinton administration.
Mm-hmm.
And the next morning, Secret Service agents were at the school, knew the computer and the time, and could sort of work the whole thing out.
So just for clarity, you're responding to Emma and saying, yes, every email message you sent is being scanned for keywords, and if they're too arresting, someone's going to be at your door?
Well, context is a big part of this. So that if you say, bomb in some sort of casual, jokey context, and you're not saying we are going to go and bomb this, that, and the other, chances are that even the computers, but certainly also any human analyst who looked at it would throw it out and not take any interest in it. I mean, we do know that there's a great deal of scanning of internet traffic, even within the United States. It's interesting, the program, another sort of mysteriously named program that did this was an FBI program called Carnivore. And a few months ago, the FBI announced that they were abandoning Carnivore.
Mm.
And a lot of civil libertarians and privacy advocates were very enthused until you actually read the fine print. And if you looked at the press conference, the FBI spokesman said, "We're abandoning this program." And people said, "Well, why?" And he said, "Well, you know, before we had to be very duplicitous and sneaky about intercepting email. But now we just go directly to the internet service providers and they give us everything. I mean, they just sort of turn everything over to us."
So I'm still curious about the audio side of this. If someone steps out in their backyard tonight and yells, you know, a series of scary words into their cell phone, you know, whatever it might be, plague and bomb and, I don't know, an airline number, without a lot of context, but yet you don't know who it might be, is that observed? Is that heard?
No.
Or not?
I mean, again, because it's spoken, unless that mm-hmm. phone was being targeted otherwise. It's very unlikely that would happen. With email, it's anybody's guess, but it's much more likely that that could be at least taken in by a computer and given a once-over.
And what's legal and what's not for U.S. surveillance of U.S. citizens?
Well, I mean, it's funny, as a law student, I should have a lot of faith in the law in this area. I mean, technically, you need some kind of probable cause or a warrant or some connection. I mean, there are different bodies of law that govern this, but some connection with a foreign terrorist organization would be what you would need in this case in order to have the probable cause to do the listening. Having said that, if you look historically, the law has not been a great constraint. So, for instance, when the NSA did this operation a few years ago to listen in on UN delegates, there are a whole series of treaties which we've signed which make it illegal to do that. There's a story I tell about a woman who worked at Menwith Hill, that big eavesdropping station in England. And during the 1980s, she was sitting next to one of these eavesdroppers, and he passed her the headphones and said, "Hey, listen to this."
Mm.
And she took the headphones, and she heard a voice, and it was a man's voice, Southern accent, American. And it sounded strangely familiar, and she said, "Who is that?" And he said, "That's Senator Strom Thurmond talking in his office in Washington, D.C."
And she's sitting in Yorkshire.
Yes. Oh. Now, it was against any number of laws for her to be listening to that conversation, but it happened anyway. And in fact, if you go right back to the worst period in the history of these kinds of intelligence agencies, to the 1960s and early 1970s, if you were vaguely anti-war, you had your phone tapped. The NSA listened in on Dr. Martin Luther King, on Jane Fonda, on Dr. Spock.
Right, and right on down the list. Alan is calling from Acton, Massachusetts. Hi, Alan. You're on the air.
Yes, good evening.
Good evening.
I was struck by your guest's estimate of the NSA budget, and it seemed to me, from my experience, that there may be a lot of items that are not included in that budget but are effectively related to exactly what its role is.
I mean, even at $6 or $7 billion, more tucked in where, Alan?
Well, I was in the British Navy for a few years 40 years ago now.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And I went in because I was a modern language major at Oxford University, and they offered the chance to learn Russian. So I thought, well, I'll pick up another language, that's great. They taught me Russian on a crash program, and then sent me to Germany, where I was monitoring with a whole bunch of other people Russian transmissions in the Baltic.
So you were there early on in this apparatus.
Right. Mm. But there were a lot of British Air Force and Army personnel as well. We shared all our information. We telexed it on a secure link back to Cheltenham, which was GCHQ headquarters at the time, and also to the American military down in Bremerhaven on the Elbe. So it struck me, listening to your program this evening, that there were a lot of military personnel in Britain and America, and American armed forces, who were in fact working for either NSA or GCHQ.
Engaged in the same thing. Alan, let us pick it up. Patrick, how about it? With that enormous budget, is it supplemented still by military intelligence?
Well, yes, and a lot of the people who are involved in the NSA are in fact military contractors from the various, I mean, they're coming in from the various wings of the armed forces. In fact, to tell you a funny story right on that note, Menwith Hill, this massive base that I mentioned, which is very much an American base in the heart of England, is technically RAF Menwith Hill.
Mm-hmm.
It's technically a Royal Air Force base. But, I mean, really in name only. You do have, I think, a couple of hundred Ministry of Defense, British Ministry of Defense employees inside. But certainly it's not RAF ends up being a convenient cover.
Patrick, you've said that right now there are big changes going on in this realm, under our noses, in your words, and that you're afraid that we'll wake up 15 years from now in a country we don't recognize around these issues of surveillance and tracking chatter. What do you mean by that?
Well, one thing I noticed as I looked into this was that there's a strong instinct that pushes these kinds of technologies and this kind of intelligence, which is this idea that if we could just see and hear everything all the time, we could keep the country safe. We could get warnings of any kind of future attack. This is an idea that I resist for a number of reasons, but it's an idea that has a lot of currency in this country right now. So if you look at the push within defense and intelligence agencies and also at the level of law enforcement, there's a real push towards something approaching total surveillance. And this is actually being met with a tremendous amount of research and development on the part of private industry.
Mm-hmm. Happy to
in
do
the
it.
Wake, exactly. I mean, there are technology firms. It's a really interesting story and one that hasn't really been told enough yet, that in the wake of 9/11, there were a whole series of technology firms and venture capitalists and people who suddenly thought, there's a gold rush on the horizon.
And
the government's panicked.
And in they rushed. We've just got a couple minutes left. You end up, after all of this traveling around the world, following the trail here, at this, being a bit frightened by what you see, but also acknowledging that there is a security threat, and you say that you yourself still don't know where the line should be drawn between security and liberty around these issues. If you can't figure it out after that big trip and all this research, what are we supposed to do?
Well, what I meant was that it's a very personal kind of line for most people. Some people are not bothered in the least by issues of privacy. Other people are. My issue is that I feel as though there's too much secrecy and not enough openness and debate. If we were to decide in anything resembling a democratic manner as a nation that we were willing to barter away X amount of liberty for Y amount of security, then far be it from me to object to that. My problem is I feel as though it's not happening in a democratic way. The debate isn't happening. The changes are happening, but we haven't really been consulted.
You quote the NSA director, Mike Hayden, saying, what I really need you, I guess he's talking with Congressman here, what I really need you to do is talk to your constituents and find out where the American people want the line between security and liberty to be.
And which is funny because he's actually asking for debate there. This is the guy who controls these technologies saying, how much can we get away with? And the irony is, I didn't read that in the press. I had to go to the Congressional Record to get that quote. Journalists did not pick up on that. Newspapers didn't pick up on it. Certainly my congresspeople didn't actually turn around and make this any kind of an issue.
Patrick,
and I feel as though... Please.
When it's all said and done, do you feel a little more naked wherever you are these days?
I do. I mean, I certainly came away with the understanding that when you make a phone call or send an email, you might as well be sending a postcard. It's out there for anybody to intercept.
Patrick Redden Keefe, has been fascinating. Thanks for your work on the book. Thanks for writing it. Thanks for being with us tonight.
Thank you for having me.
Patrick Redden Keefe, author of the new book, Chatter, Dispatches from the Secret World of Global Eavesdropping. In a moment, a look at President Bush's controversial choice to head up the World Bank. This is On Point. President Bush announced in a news conference this morning that he is nominating Paul Wolfowitz, a top Pentagon official and one of the chief architects of the war in Iraq, to head the World Bank.
He helped manage a large organization. World Bank's a large organization. The Pentagon's a large organization. He's been involved in the management of that organization. He's a skilled diplomat, worked at the State Department in high positions. He's the ambassador to Indonesia, where he did a very good job representing our country. And Paul is committed to development. He's a compassionate, decent man who will do a fine job in the World Bank.
Wolfowitz is best known as an ardent neoconservative at the right hand of Pentagon Chief Donald Rumsfeld. The international community has been critical of U.S. policy in Iraq generally, and overseas reaction to today's announcement was muted. Wolfowitz must still receive approval from the board of the World Bank sometime before May, when the bank's current president, American James Wolfensohn, steps down. David Ignatius is a columnist for The Washington Post and joins me now from Washington to talk about President Bush's choice to head the World Bank. David, thanks for being with us tonight.
Happy to be with you, Tom.
Just on the face of it, what do you make of President Bush choosing this man, with all of his background and baggage, some would say, for this position?
Well, it's obviously going to be a controversial choice, and in that sense is risky. Wolfowitz, by training, by intellect, in many ways is a sensible choice for an organization like this. He's passionate about development. Oddly, he really is better suited to this kind of soft power role than the hard power role he's been playing at the Pentagon as an ambassador in Indonesia. He was deeply interested in development. He has a passion for the Islamic world that's unusual, I think, in U.S. intellectual life. So all those are good things. The problem is that this will be seen around the world, I think, as an attempt to militarize or mobilize the World Bank. Mobilize is the right word, for the larger U.S. ambition of fighting the war on terrorism, of transforming the Middle East and the Islamic world. In that sense, it will be seen as an extension of Wolfowitz's mission at the Pentagon. And that's going to worry people. They like to think of the World Bank as in a different sphere, involved in development, relieving poverty, all the things we associate with the World Bank, not as something that's mobilized in a global onslaught against the enemies of the United States and the West.
David Ignatius, remind us of the structure here. We've got the International Monetary Fund, which I guess by tradition Europe puts up a head for, and the World Bank, which the U.S. puts up a head for, nominates, proposes a head for.
Yes.
Is there a chance that we would see Europe or others push vigorously back against Wolfowitz? Would there be a way for them to do that?
Well, there's certainly a chance that they would do that, and it's important to remember that in terms of the actual capital structure of the World Bank, you know, the voting capital shares, the United States has today less than 20%. So the United States needs, on a practical basis, the consensus of the other key donors to the World Bank to make that institution function. I think the other thing to remember is that the United States was unhappy about a European nominee for the IMF, which is traditionally a European prerogative, and Larry Summers, when he was Treasury Secretary, successfully combated a German who was proposed.
Under Bill Clinton, right.
Yes, during the Clinton administration. Mm-hmm. And it may well be that the Europeans will say, well, you know, fair is fair. You shot down somebody we liked, and we're not happy with this nominee, and we're gonna shoot down that person. That would lead to a very unpleasant transatlantic row. That's one reason I'm a bit surprised by the administration's decision to go forward with this nomination. With this, as with the plan to nominate John Bolton for the United Nations ambassador's job.
A great critic of the UN, Bolton.
A strong critic of the UN, again, a controversial person. It seems to me that you can argue the administration is working at cross purposes. Clearly, in this second term, Bush does want to work more closely with his European allies. He knows he needs help to accomplish the goals he's set, so we're seeing cooperation on Iran and other issues. At the same time that they're doing that, they're also putting forward as spokesmen, as very visible people, people who are going to upset the Europeans.
And how do you interpret that, David? Why?
Well, you know, one thing I've found, certainly over the first 4 years of this administration's foreign policy, is that they often go in different directions. You know, this has been a very internally contradictory group. They had trouble coming up with one policy for Iran. They had trouble coming up with one policy for Iraq, for that matter. And I worry that same kind of confusion, cross-purposes mood is continuing in the second term.
And at the World Bank, how do you imagine them receiving with their development mission, Mr. Wolfowitz?
You know, Paul Wolfowitz is, as I say, I think is a very admirable person, often gets an unfair, nasty press. Because he's a genuinely distinguished intellectual, he will, over time, I think, win over many of his critics at the World Bank. I'm told that he had a long, several hours long meeting last night with Jim Wolfensohn, the current head of the bank. But they got along well. Wolfensohn has issued a statement publicly and more important, internally, supporting Wolfowitz and making a case for him. So I think if he's given a chance, he's the sort of person who could win people over.
So a new seat and a big seat for Paul Wolfowitz. David Ignatius, with that, I'm afraid we're out of time. I'm so grateful to you for being with us tonight.
Thanks so much.
David Ignatius, columnist for The Washington Post. Listeners, thanks for joining us tonight. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
On Point is a production of WBUR Boston and NPR, National Public Radio.